This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Tony Brown produced 37 number one songs for country legend George Strait. He signed a little band named Alabama to RCA Records before anybody knew who Alabama was. And when Lionel Richie decided he wanted to remake his hit songs featuring famous country acts, who did he call? Tony Brown. Tony chronicles his life in his book, Elvis Straight to Jesus, An Iconic Producer's Journey with Legends of Rock and Roll, Country, and Gospel Music. That book features photos and memories with many influencers who helped build his legacy. His story is filled with the glitz and glamour of the music business, but that is not where it begins. Tony Brown got his start in Greensboro, and he joins me now in the State of Things. Tony, welcome.
Good morning, Frank.
That hospital where you were born might have been in Greensboro, but then you're really raised in Walkertown. Now, tell us all about that.
That's right. I was raised in Walkertown down Camp Betty Hastings Road, and it seemed like another life, actually. We were very poor, and we lived at the end of a dead-end road, and so life was pretty simple.
How simple?
In those days.
How simple?
Very simple. We had, didn't have indoor plumbing. And no TV. I wasn't allowed to watch TV, but pretty much just did a lot of hiking was the entertainment that was us boys did in Walkertown, because we were surrounded by woods, and so we'd just go walking. And I remember that was so much fun.
Wow. Tell us a little bit.
Exploring a new world.
Well, talk about that world. I mean, there's another world around you. Had you been able to watch TV, you might have seen what you were missing. But I guess you didn't know what you were missing, right?
No, I didn't even know we were poor. I was telling Dana the other day when I was talking to her, I said, I knew we didn't have as much as a lot of other people, but I didn't realize how poor we really were until I got older. And when I moved to L.A., I really understood how poor we were. In fact, I told her out there, I learned the difference between they have money and they are rich. George Strait has money. Bill Gates is rich.
Yeah, well, and there's another kind of poverty in L.A., but we won't get to all of that. Tell us so what was it that you were doing, you and the guys you were hanging out with? You talked about exploring. What kind of exploration? What did you do for fun?
Well, we lived really way out in the sticks, as they say. And so there was a lot of acreage around our house, nothing but woods. And so we'd just go different directions every weekend and walk until we got tired. And then occasionally we would end up on a highway and didn't know where we were, way 20 miles from home. And we didn't have cell phones back then. So we would have to retrace our way back to the house. And to me, that was a big adventure. I remember how much fun that was. Now, it didn't cost a thing.
Talk about your father and perhaps why you weren't able to watch TV. What did he do?
Well, my dad, when I was 6 years old, he was diagnosed with lung cancer, and he was given 3 months to live. So he had to quit his job at a dairy, like a purity dairies kind of place. And so he decided that God had called him to preach, and so he started doing evangelizing, and we would sing behind him. We were the band. He would play piano, and the two brothers of mine and myself and my sister would sing, and we just sang at all kinds of churches, like every Baptist, Methodist, Moravian, Pentecostal, Salvation Army, you name it, black churches. So that really kind of opened my eyes to the whole world of music, because in Baptist churches, the music was pretty simple, and the choir, everybody pretty much sang out of tune. And then you go to these black churches, and it sounds like Mahalia Jackson and Aretha Franklin's got a backup group in there. It's really good. And then Pentecostal churches always had great musicians, and I don't know, I just saw a lot of different dynamics in religion. That's why to this day I still am kind of fascinated when I see a documentary on HBO, like about Scientologists. I just want to know what that's all about, because I was raised in a really strict evangelical home. And as I grew older, I realized there was a lot more than that going on.
Do Did you develop an interest in music and or religion through all of that?
I think I developed an interest in music. My brothers, who were older than me, ended up going to Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, which is basically a religious college. And one brother became a minister and still is. But I sort of learned to play piano by accident when I was 13. At church, there was a lady named Connie, and she heard me messing on the piano one day. She said, "I'm gonna play you something, and you play what I plays." And she played me something in the key of C, all white notes. And I played it back to her, and she said, "You know what? I think you have an ear. I'm gonna teach you a song, and maybe your family can learn to sing it." And so I did. And I remember the first time my dad called me to the piano to play that song at church, it blew the roof off. And I pretty much got the bug that, hey, this maybe I should do more of this. Maybe learn two songs. and eventually I just really got attached to listening to music. But the only music I could hear was gospel groups, which I loved at the time. And when I was going to school, I mean, people would talk about Elvis and all that kind of stuff, but I didn't really listen to him. I had never heard him, but I knew he was a star. Mm-hmm. And I just got interested in black churches had different kind of music than Pentecostal churches, and Baptist churches were different than all the other. And I just sort of picked up on that and got really interested in learning how to become a part of, put all of that into my music. And so when I played, I'd always ask to play a song that was more up-tempo or more contemporary than maybe what my brothers would like.
And all of this, you hadn't learned to read music. You weren't reading.
I've never read music. I can't read music to this day.
So there you, but your ears are reading music pretty well,
yes.
And they're talking to your hands. And so your parents see this, and they send you to a six-week camp in Dallas, right?
That's right. You know, I was 15, and so my brothers had gone to Bob Jones University. They were really like made great grades in school. I didn't. So my dad had noticed how much I loved playing the piano, so he heard about this school in Dallas, Texas, called the Stamps Quartet School of Music. And you could go down there and learn how to sight read. You could learn how to direct choirs. You could learn how to play quartet music. So I went down there, and there was a lady named Linda Robinson. She noticed I had a good ear, so she took me under her wing and taught me how to do some flashy little licks and stuff, like some of these gospel musicians that I had heard that were really great. So when I came back from Dallas, my playing had gotten much better, a lot more, a lot of flourishes to it. And so I flash forward. After that, then Linda Robinson asked my dad to let me move down to Louisiana with her family, who was a gospel group as well. And she said, "I'll teach him for free if you let him stay with us for a year and he can play in our band."
Now, you were 14 at the time, though, right?
Right. No, I was 15.
15,
actually.
All right.
Yeah. And so that opened my eyes to a whole other thing, because they were very religious fanatics, too. But they went to ball games. They had a TV. They went to movies. And so I was opened up to a whole new world.
Now, why do you think your parents, you think about this, why would they let you do that? I mean, you're a 15-year-old young man, and again, you know, they're a religious family, but they do some things that your father frowned on. He may have known that going in.
I don't think he did. Uh-huh. Actually, you know, I think they realized, like my brother, oldest brother, was a valedictorian at school, so he went to Bob Jones and ended up getting a master's degree. And I think they noticed that I probably wouldn't be going to college because I barely made good grades in school. And I think my dad was smart enough to realize that my college was going to be like the Stamp School of Music, and mm-hmm. then going down and living with my piano teacher's family. And he was sending me off to school, basically.
Yeah. You know?
And it didn't cost him anything. I'm sure, I don't know what Bob Jones charged for tuition, but I'm sure it was yeah. beyond the means of my mom and dad, because we lived very, very simple.
And then after a year in Louisiana, you moved back to North Carolina and
That's
spent
right.
11th and 12th grade living with a family in Durham, right? Tell us about
That's
that.
That's right. After I got back, then my dad had been playing with a group in Durham, piano for quartet. And when I got back from Louisiana, he said, you know, I'm tired of doing that. I'll suggest that they hire you to replace me because you're getting really good. So I did a move to Durham and lived there for my 11th and 12th grade and graduated from school there. And I was getting a little better every time. And plus I was learning to be kind of a showman, you know. And when I grew up, the Blackwood Brothers had a piano player named Jackie Marshall, who was like a ragtime player. And he was just next to the quartet. He was the star of the show. And when he left, a guy named Wally Varner came, same thing. So I noticed the piano player, because in quartets, there was no band. It was a piano player and a quartet. So I realized that I could actually do a little upstaging if I added a little showbiz to my playing. So I learned how to do that.
Tony Brown tells his story through pictures in his book, through pictures and some captions in a book called Elvis Straight to Jesus, An Iconic Producer's Journey with Legends of Rock and Roll, Country, and Gospel Music. Tony, one of those legends is J.D. Sumner, who was certainly someone you idolized growing up, had that incredibly low bass voice and really helped, I think, bring Southern gospel into the mainstream. And you got a call. Tell us about getting that call.
Yes, you know, after I had finished playing in Durham with that last quartet, they started playing concerts, and so people would notice me playing, and J.D. Sumner heard about me. And to me, J.D. was my aim to get to play for him would be it. That would, my career would be, have reached its peak. And I got the call to come play and try out for the Stamps Quartet. And I did that, and I got the job. And I thought that was, well, I've reached it. This is it. But little did I know that down the road, every little connection in my life would lead to an opportunity of another thing connected with that relationship. And my book sort of tells that, like, it is who you know, but it's not who you know, like, you use that person. It's just it leads you to opportunities that you have to be willing to look into and accept or walk away from. And my book just tells a story how every new relationship led me to another relationship and to a better job. And I had to get better each time because every position I got in demanded more from me. So I just had to do a fast study.
Well, talk about this stop with J.D. Sumner. What did you learn? How did you feel yourself developing? Because already a lot of people have noticed you know what you're doing. You're awfully good. You got the gig. You must have been that good. Then what did you learn through the process of playing with the Stamps?
Well, you know, I don't know how many people have seen Southern gospel is not the art form now that it was back then. Back in those days, there were maybe four or five really superstar groups, the Blackwood Brothers, the Statesmen, the Stamps Quartet, the Spear Family, and the Lefevers, and they were the superstars. And when I got with J.D., J.D. had been with the Blackwood Brothers for years, and when he left, it really dealt them a real loss because J.D. was the world's lowest bass singer, and supposedly it's in the Guinness Book of World Records that he's the world's lowest bass singer. And with the Blackwood Brothers, James Blackwood was the head of that group, the Blackwood Brothers, James Blackwood, and he was very serious. And J.D. was kind of the guy he picked on. And J.D. was kind of funny. So when I got with the Stamps Quartet, J.D. said that he was going to make me to be the funny guy, and he was going to be the straight guy. He was going to be James Blackwood, and I was going to be J.D. And he gave me a nickname, Tarzan. And I said, why that? He said, because you're the least thing like Tarzan you could possibly be, and it'll be funny. And then, you know, he was 6'7", and I was probably back then maybe 5'2". I'm 5'5" now. But I would run across the stage and leap through the air, and he'd catch me in his arms. So he started teaching me all these things to do, how to be funny, you know. And each thing I learned from him, I was going, I'm kind of digging this attention I'm getting.
Now, did it occur to you anywhere along the line, were you crestfallen at all? Maybe you didn't get the gig for your piano chops? It could have been just because you were small enough to
look like. You know, I think JD actually did look at my size and the fact that he is 6'7".
Yeah.
But I think I got the gig for my piano playing, but,
but it was
just think when he met me, and he realized I probably like germed him really bad when I first met him. I can't remember exactly.
The balance between, because you're also talking about what I'm hearing you saying throughout this conversation, as you progress in your career, you're getting much better at your piano chops. People are noticing, but you're also really liking the performance, the being on stage and getting the attention. How do you manage that in a group, for instance, when it's J.D. Sumner that everybody came to see, but you've got a role to play as an entertainer?
Well, you know, now that I'm have been a record man for like 25 or 30 years, and you start noticing things about people that have charisma, like what attracts you to some artists is their talent, their voice, or their songwriting. And there's some that attract you that their charisma, like Lyle Lovett, the first thing that caught my eye was the way he looked. And then I realized later on how great of a songwriter he was. So, you know, back in the days when I was with J.D. Sumner, quartets were really more of a show than it was worship. Now, like contemporary Christian music is more like worship music. Quartets still exist thanks to Bill Gaither, but they're not the same thing as they were back in those days. And so everybody in the Stamps Quartet, when I joined them, he had already hired like some ringers like Jim Hill, who was one of the most famous tenor singers in the business, and had written a big famous song called What a Day That Will Be. Then he hired J.D. Sumner, or he hired his own nephew, Donnie Sumner. He hired James Blackwood's son, Jimmy Blackwood. And then the piano player, I think he just wanted someone he could let someone that could be his, is the muse the right word? Or would he be my muse? I don't know.
And as you say, a straight man, somebody he can pass off to,
You know, the other guys in the band were actually of such stature, I think they would have been beneath them to do that. And, you know, he would tell me to do things like one night he said, okay, Tarzan, we're in Chicago at a big concert in the Medina Temple, like 5,000 people. He said, in a minute, you're going to come up to the front and say, J.D., I kissed every girl that came in the building tonight. And J.D. said, I'll say, no, you did not. He said, I did, every single one. And then he said, you'll say, if I miss somebody, please stand up. And he said, only one person will have the nerve to do that. I said, but J.D., what if like 10 stand up? He says, trust me, it'll be one person every night. And I did it, and he was exactly right. And then I would run off the stage, up into the balcony, kiss that person, and come back. Stuff like that. It's almost like a vaudeville show. But, you know, all that stuff, I was paying attention, man. I was like paying really attention to the things he was telling me. And I remember that's what caught my attention about him was not only his bass singing, but he was just such a character on stage with the Blackwood Brothers.
We would certainly hope that individual wanted that attention. And
like James Blackwood and the other three guys in the group were very serious and pretty much would testify and stuff when they would speak. And J.D., was always sort of throwing in a little satire or something into the show. You know, I don't think you could do that today in Christian music like that.
Yeah, well,
but anyway, it was show business for me. I really took it as show business. I think a lot of people in contemporary Christian today believe it's a ministry for them. I mean, they really approach it from that angle.
Well, let's talk about, you talked about the connections and the fact that J.D. had hired his nephew, who actually got you a job with Elvis. Talk about that.
Okay, well, you know, I was with J.D., and we were a big time superstar group. there was a group called the Oak Ridge Boys that had sort of started raising their profile. And they were all good-looking guys, man. They all looked like movie stars. And they wore bell bottoms and platform shoes. And they had real long hair, like the Beatles. And they had a full band. And so they stole me away from the Stamps Quartet. And I left J.D. Sumner and the Stamps to go with the Oak Ridge Boys because it was a cooler gig. Plus, they paid me a little bit more money. You know, back in those days, it was if you could make... I think I made $175 with JD, and the Oak Ridge Boys paid me $200. So that was a big deal, 25 more bucks a week. Wow. But anyway, I did that. And after I'd been with the Oaks for about a year, JD calls me and said, "Tarzan, you messed up. Elvis fired the Imperials, and he hired JD Sumner and the Stamps, and we're touring with Elvis. You could have been here." And then he hung up. And I was thinking, I like my gig now. I was really digging the Oaks. We were like becoming the hottest cool group in the business. All of a sudden, I started learning I wanted to be cool. That was really important. I guess it's vanity at its best, I guess. But after about a year, Donnie Sumner called me and said, "Hey, JD just fired me. And Elvis worships JD, but he loves my singing." And he called me and said, "Donnie, get a couple other guys and a piano player, and I'll just hire you to sing around my house when I'm not touring. Beverly Hills, Graceland, Palm Springs. And you want this gig?" I said, "Duh, yeah."
But this is Elvis. This is again J.D. Sumner's nephew, who's right. Used to work with you. Then he calls up and says, "Hey, guess what, Elvis just asked me to get a group together to hang out at his house and sing gospel
songs." Yeah. I mean, that sounds kind of weird.
A little, but once, yeah.
If you had been around Elvis and you knew Elvis the way I now know him, gospel music, he wanted to be in the Blackwood Brothers or with the Stamps, and he never got a chance to be. That's why he always sang gospel songs in his shows. That was his favorite music. And so... he gave Donnie that opportunity. I mean, Elvis never calls anybody. Usually his people call everybody. Right. But he called Donnie, and so Donnie, I took that job, and we started just going to that call and say, "Elvis is, wants you guys to come out to Beverly Hills. Go check in the hotel in Hollywood, and we'll call you when he gets up." And then we'd get the call, we'd go to the house, and he'd come out about 7 or 8 o'clock. And we'd sing gospel songs all night long, you know, Peace in the Valley, basic, just real, real standard gospel songs, the hymn songs.
Now, did he join in, or did he just sit
and listen? Oh, no, yeah. He'd come in the living room. We, of course, we're all sitting there like we're his servants.
Yeah.
And he'd start humming Peace in the Valley, and my job was to run to the piano, find out what key he was in, and he'd sing it. And and then he'd say, "Let's do it again. I'm going to sing bass this time." And we'd sing it again. He'd say, "Let's do it again. I'm going to sing tenor." And we'd do it again. And stuff like that. And then we would do it in Palm Springs as well. Never went to Graceland to do that. He was usually wanting to get out of Memphis, I think, when he did that. And so that eventually led to us being put on the tour in the front of the Comedian, because Elvis's show was always a Comedian for 30 minutes, the Sweet Inspirations, who were in the backup group, but they sang two or three of their big hits when they were the Sweet Inspirations, and then Elvis. So Elvis put us in front of the Comedian to do two songs, and we had to do pop songs, and I was embarrassed. Voice was the worst pop group I've ever heard. I mean, Donnie Sumner had that vibrato of a gospel singer, and so we'd do our two songs like anybody gave a flip about it. Then I would go sit behind Glenn D. Harden, who was Elvis's piano player in the TCB band, and watch the rest of the show. And about a year and a half into the tour, he told me he was leaving to go play with Emmylou Harris. And I hustled the show. I'd learned to hustle by that time. And so, you know, it is who you know.
So you ended up playing Elvis for piano for Elvis.
Yeah, I played the last year and a half with Elvis. I played his very last show. We were at the airport on the 16th waiting for the show plane to land from L.A. to pick us Nashville cats up to go to Maine the next night for the 17th in Portland, Maine. And before the plane could get there, the colonel sent in his day-to-day guy and said, "Hey, guys, the tour's off. We'll call you." And we just left. And on the way home, I heard on the radio that Elvis had been found dead in his bathroom. And my first thought, this is horrible, my first thought is, I'd already spent the money I was going to make. I lived at one paycheck ahead. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? And so that's what happened.
What is it like to be on tour? Because this is toward the end of his career. Things had really taken a change. The show had gotten very big. He had gotten very big. What was it like to be with him?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that was the first big, I mean, gospel concerts were not anything like that. But on Elvis, there were four airplanes. The colonel had a plane. He flew a day ahead to set up the next town. The show plane was the band, which started in L.A. and pick up James Burton and all those guys, stop in Vegas to get the orchestra, Joe Gershio and the Sweet Inspirations, and stop in Nashville to get the rest of us who were in Nashville, myself and David Briggs. The crew, Clare Brothers, the band, I mean, the sound guys had a plane. So there were four airplanes. It was like an Air Force.
Yeah.
And
but
so
I mean,
Elvis
is it, that's what I mean. What's it like to be with him? Is he at this point, was he really engaged with the music? Did he seem
who
had become sort of separated from it all?
I was never allowed to see him after I played with the big band.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had not played with Voice, I would have never got to know the man. I mean, he would get to the Coliseum just as we were getting ready to play the Space Odyssey. They'd play him on, and then at the end, we do I Can't Help Falling in Love, and then we'd play the playoff, which is basically C.C. Rider. And by the time we finished, he was on his way to the airport, headed to the next town.
What about in his house, when you just a little before that again? Because we get a sense, the story, you know, the received story is that he had become somewhat disengaged. I mean, the thing had become a show, and he was a kind of a mascot for a thing, but no longer, you know, in touch with his own art.
Well, you know, I think... Well, you know, he had a prescription drug problem, which I didn't know anything about at the time. And I think the reason he really wanted Voice to be his house band, he wanted to engage with some musicians. The colonel wouldn't allow anybody backstage to see Elvis. I mean, in L.A., I remember seeing the Eagles, James Taylor trying to get backstage. The only person that was ever allowed backstage when I was with Elvis was Elton John. In Washington, D.C. And when Elton left, one of Elvis's ballet guys says, Elvis didn't even know who he was.
And
of course, Elton John was my Elvis. I worshiped him.
Yeah.
So
well,
passing him backstage going, oh my God, that's Elton John going to see Elvis.
I know that guy. Where do I know that guy? Oh, yeah. You talked about the piano player, the pianist for Elvis Moves On. That's how you get the gig to actually play with the big band. And then he went on to play for Emmylou Harris, and so did
That's
you.
Right.
Right.
Well, you know, I found out at a recording session in Hollywood when I was with Voice, Glenn D. Hard and James Burton, who were two of the mainstays of Elvis's band from the very beginning, we would come to the studio and they would be talking about, hey, we just did all day sessions with a new Warner Brothers country act named Emmylou Harris, and she is amazing. And so I kept wondering who she was, and I didn't even listen to country music back then at all. And so when Glenn D told me about a year and a half into the gig, he says, you know, Emmy's going to start touring on this new album, and when a new artist tours, if they're a pop band or a country band, they don't, like Elvis was doing 10 days every month, same 10 days. But new bands tour for a year. So Emmy was doing a world tour that was going to be a year long. And she asked James Burton and Glenn D to go, and James would not leave Elvis. But Glenn D did. So I play a lot like Mindy. So I got the job with Elvis with no rehearsal. Mm. And then that, after Elvis passed on the 16th, about a month later, I'm sitting in David Briggs's office, who was the other keyboard player of Elvis, and he had a publishing company. And he said, Ed Tickner said that Glenn D. just left Emmy Lou Harris to go tour for a year with John Denver.
Talking to Tony Brown, whose career spans more than four decades in country music, started out playing piano at gospel revivals, ended up president of MCA Nashville, shaping what country music is today. So talk about that, because you've been playing all this time, and at some point you realized you need to get a real job. What got you into producing?
Well, you know, after Elvis passed, and I went with Emmy Lou Harris, and we toured pretty steadily for a year, and then she got pregnant, and she decided to get off the road for about a year. And so the old hot band, here I am without a job again. I'm living in Los Angeles. old hot band decided to get with Rodney Crowell, who'd been part of the hot band, and start playing clubs up and down the coast of California for the Door. And that's where the Cherry Bombs, the old hot band, became the Cherry Bombs. In fact, I got a poster that Rodney had drawn of it. Said, Rodney Crowell, a boy and a hot band, the Cherry Bombs. And it was all the ex-Emmy Lou Harris players. So I did that, and then we cut records with Rodney for Warner Brothers, and then he married Roseanne Cash. The Cherry Bombs became Roseanne Cash's band as well, so I was playing with Rodney and Roseanne. And then eventually Roseanne got pregnant twice, out of a job again. So I moved back to Nashville and decided go running back to David Briggs, my other partner with Elvis's band. And I said, hey, David, I don't want to play for just anybody now that I played with Elvis and Emmy Lou. You know, I had a little bit of a toad going on there. I need a real job. And so he mentioned to me that Jerry Bradley, who was running RCA at the time, who's the son of Owen Bradley, the fabulous Owen Bradley, and he said they're giving Jerry Bradley a pop label in Los Angeles, and they're trying to shove these couple of these New Yorkers down his throat to be his A&R man. And Jerry is such a redneck that I'll tell him he should hire you, and he will. And that's exactly what happened. Once again, who you know. Mm. So I moved back to L.A., worked at RCA for 2 years. They shut down the pop label. Didn't happen. Moved back to Nashville in 80 and got a job in the country A&R department. Then while I was there, I signed this band in Alabama that was a local band out of Alabama that was playing clubs, and the word was spreading that they were pretty good. Little did I know that they would become the biggest country band ever.
Well, did you know? You could go back now in hindsight and say whatever you want, but at the time, were you just signing another band, or could you hear something?
No, they were playing. There's a thing that happens in Nashville every February called the CRS, which is Country Radio Seminar, and every label puts on shows with their big acts to get to sort of play to the program directors at radio stations. And then there's a show called the New Faces Show where brand new acts that just got signed get to play. And then if there's an indie band on an indie label can work the way in, because it's mainly for major labels. And so this record label that Alabama had cut a record on called MDJ Records weaseled their way in, and they got on the show and they blew everybody away. And I told my boss, Joe Galani, who worked for Bradley. Bradley was the CEO, Joe was the president, and I was a manager. I was the lowest level A&R person there was. And I told Joe, I said, I think we ought to sign them. He said, you better, because if you don't sign them, I'm going to sign them, and you're an A&R.
So that makes your reputation. At this point, now people are paying attention.
I'm the guy. I'm the genius. And the thing that gave me the courage to sign them was that one of my bosses, Joe Galani, says, if you don't sign them, I'm going to.
There you go.
And he wanted me to have a feather in my hat, so I did sign them. And to this day, when I see Randy Owen He never fails to come up to me. If I'm across the room, he'll walk all the way across the room. Randy's the lead singer, and say, "Hey, man, I just want to tell you, I'll never forget the favor you did for us when you signed us." Because I picked up that record they'd put out, redid the cover, and put it on RCA Records. It was already a finished album. And they had a song called Tennessee River that ended up being their big hit when they signed RCA, that was already getting airplay down in Birmingham and in their local stations where they live. But it ended up being like a big feather in my hat, and it was kind of, you know, kind of an accident, but I was paying attention. Once again, I just learned that, man, I'm kind of, you know, I want to get bigger and better, and I guess there's a little narcissism
maybe a little
in there somewhere.
But, well, and Alabama does pretty well, but nobody has sold as many, has had as many number one hits as George Strait.
George Strait, 60, more, nobody, and I did 37.
In any genre, in any genre.
In any genre, yeah. That's right. And, but, you know.
Why'd you get connected with him?
Well, here's the deal. I wanted to produce at RCA, but they wouldn't let me produce because I didn't have a track record. And I told Joe, "Well, how do you get a track record if you don't get an opportunity? What's the deal here?" Mm-hmm. And so my boss in A&R was a guy named Nora Wilson, who's very famous. He's passed, but you know, he wrote a lot of George Jones songs, and he produced the early records on Bill Anderson. He was quite a character in Nashville, and he said, I told him that story. He said, "Well, listen, man, I'm doing Steve Warner. I got two more songs to cut. Why don't you just co-produce those two with me?" And I did, and the song went number one. And all of a sudden, I'm a producer. And I think back on that, I didn't even charge to do that, because when you're a producer with a label, you still have you get to charge a producing fee, and you get percentage from the album sales and stuff. But I did that, it went number one.
What was the album?
It was a song called Midnight Fire on Steve Warner. Yeah. And Nora and I co-produced it. So in 80, the winter of 83, after I've signed Alabama and I've done a number one song, I get word that Jimmy Bowen, who had just moved to town from L.A., who did, you know, he was famous for producing Sinatra, Dean Martin, Kenny Rogers in the First Edition. He was just involved in so many things. He moved to town to take over Warner Brothers. And word got, and that's when he made Hank Jr. Like, Hank Jr. had been struggling around town to be somebody, to live up to his dad's legacy, and couldn't get arrested. And Bowen made him into the biggest entertainer.
But talk about, let me stop you there and ask you about that, because George Strait, again, here's somebody who apparently has, you know, what it takes to sell a lot of records. What's the role of a producer? What do you think your role and your connection
I'm just, it's changed. You know, when Bowen came to town, he came to town because he'd been watching, and I'm definitely trained by Jimmy Bowen. I consider myself trained by Jimmy Bowen. But he came to town, all the labels were run by people who were suits, you know, money counters. And Bowen said they should be run by creative people. So he came to town to run Warner Brothers. He broke Hank Jr. And then word started to spread that back in those days, people didn't change jobs. Like, Bowen wouldn't have left to go to another label. The word got that Bowen was taking over MCA. He took over Warner Brothers, and now he's taking over MCA. And so I'm at RCA making $30,000 a year, not getting to produce anything unless Nora Wilson feels sorry for me. And I get a phone call to go play on a session that Jimmy Bowen is producing. It's the Hank Jr. session. And I go, and on the way there, I realize that I'm out of my league, and I should tell them they shouldn't have hired me. So Bowen calls me upstairs and tells me that he didn't really want me to play. He just wanted to have a meeting with me, that he's taking over MCA. And I said, "I heard that." He said, "And I want you to be my A&R guy. You signed Alabama, right?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "That Steve Warner record, I could train you to be a great producer. And that's music to my ears." And so I hustled that gig and got it. stayed there for 25 years till I became president.
Well, again, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. I'll talk maybe about your project with Lionel Richie, right? Because that was in 2012.
Here's the deal. When I first came to MCA, Bowen was the CEO, Bruce Hinton was president, and I was executive vice president of A&R. Bowen said, I'll produce the stars, and you bring some new stuff to the label. I'll take care of all the big stars, like Strait and Reba and the Oak Ridge Boys and Lee Greenwood and all that kind of stuff. And so my first act I brought him was Patti Loveless. He thought she was a hick, and I thought she was awesome. And I stood my ground and got her signed. And then I brought him Steve Earle, and he thought that was a joke. And I stood my ground, got Steve Earle a record deal, and Lyle Lovett. And then Bowen let me co-produce Jimmy Buffett with him. So I started moving into more of the mainstream stuff. And then when Bowen left MCA in, I think it was like maybe 99, he went to Capitol to take over Capitol. And I became the president. And then I by default, I got Reba and George Strait and Wynonna, because it was time for the next record to be made, and Bowen was gone. And you don't let another label's president produce your artist. That's a no-no. So I just got those sort of by default. And the first record I did was Pure Country, which was George's movie that didn't do good, but this album sold 6 million records. And up to that point, he'd only been selling 1 million. I got Reba, and the first record we cut on her was Fancy. And she said she wanted to cut it, and Bowen wouldn't let her. Would I cut it? I said, absolutely, because I love that song. Ended up being, wasn't a number one song, but it's the biggest song in her repertoire. If you go see Reba McEntire and she doesn't do Fancy, you're going to be upset.
I do want to get a sense, though, because we've heard a lot in the record industry, you know, records, a label might say, well, okay, we cut this album and you're great. I mean, George Strait's a pretty good example of having a record. Lionel Richie is somebody who's, you know, records maybe sell well, but they don't get the kind of promotion. And we know that the record company has a lot to do with whether I'm going to put it in the back corner or promote
it. That's right.
And so on the one hand, there's talent. There's you maybe saying, hey, I hear it when you don't, Patti Loveless, not a hick. Let's sign her. On the other hand, the record company has something to say about that, right? About how well you're going to do.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and everybody thinks just because you're in the hierarchy, like when I was president, I've had records I made that were my favorite ones that never came out. You know, everybody has to be in line. The stars have to line up. The manager has to be in sync with the label heads. The artist and the producer have to be in sync with the label and the promotion and marketing. Everything's got to line up. And so I got George's Pure Country record just by luck. And then I got Reba. She was already a superstar. And then, you know, Bowen had signed the Judds to MCA. And then when he left, Naomi got hepatitis, I think. And she had to retire. And so the first record that Judds did didn't exist, so it ended up being just Wynonna's first album.
Well, what's interesting now is you've left the business, we thought, except you're working now with a young and up-and-coming star. Let's take a listen to Emmy Sunshine.
She's been playing music since she was 5. Tonight, she's joined by her dad, her uncle, and her brother. Make some noise for Emmy Sunshine.
Emmy Sunshine and Little Big Shots and Tony Brown's newest artist. How old is she? She's playing the ukulele, right? And that's
She's 14 now. It was last year. She was 13, and she's 14, but she's an old soul. And I really believe God sent her to me. It's like I'm not working anymore with George Strait or Reba or anyone, and I was looking for a way to get myself to get the fire, creative fire burning in me. And her and her manager came to my house a day before her family played a club here in town. And I met her on her 13th birthday. And man, it just, all of a sudden I was going, I'm looking at a star. I met Alison Krauss when she was 13. I knew Tanya when she was 14. And I'm going, this is the real deal right here. So I've cut four things on her, and I'm label shopping actually this week to try to get her a label. And I think she's like Kacey Musgraves, Brandi Carlile, Alison Krauss. She's part of that new guard of young girls that have something to say. You know, she writes really great, man. I am so excited about this. In fact, when I leave here, I'm going to meet her. We're going to Sony Records to do a little dog and pony show and see if they like her.
Yeah, she can write music, and when you watch her, she knows the song. I mean, she is, as you say, she's grown when she sings.
It's like
that song.
You know, you see her now, and she's 14.
Yeah,
and she looks older than 14, and her voice doesn't sound. I mean, since that show, Little Big Shots, her voice has really matured. And it doesn't sound like a little girl. It sounds like just a young girl. And she's got a ukulele endorsement. You know, there's a girl named Billie Eilish that's the pop sensation right now on Interscope Records. She's 16, plays the ukulele, and she's the brand new big pop star. She plays all around the world. She has one song that has 1 billion streams. And she dresses crazy. Emmy's the same way. Emmy dresses crazy, has her own look. I'm telling you, I'm putting all my coins on this one. I just think that she's. And then after I got to know her, I found out that her family, they live in Madisonville, Tennessee. They started out singing gospel music, got into bluegrass music. Now they're doing a kind of an Americana kind of thing.
Tony Brown, an award-winning country music producer known for making hits with George Strait, Reba McEntire, and now Emmy Sunshine. His book, Elvis, Straight to Jesus, an iconic producer's journey with legends of rock and roll, country, and gospel music. Thanks so much for being on the show, Tony. Good to talk with you.
You too, Frank, always.